This is Phil Ferrand, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I don't think I'm going to need to come in tomorrow, although it is, we're closing the year tomorrow. Woohoo! We think. The company that I've been, my major client, has been just working like crazy to get all the final contributions in for this year, and they've been doing a good job, and the applications have been holding up, and we always like it when things work. So, the other big news from Springfield, Missouri, is that we are in the middle, like the rest of the country, of a cold wave. I should say, like, the most of the southern east portion. Wow, it's been cold, comparatively, for us here. I mean, tomorrow, they said that the high is going to be 6, and the low is going to be -7. So, man, that is unusual for us. We're all standing here looking at each other going, what? So anyways, it's a little chilly here, but that's okay. I have been rejoicing all week and just going, thank you, God, for warm showers. Thank you that I have heat in my house. I can't imagine trying to survive outside in this kind of weather. Anyways, I have restarted my complaint-free world challenge, No Grace. I had a few little bumps along the way, but I have been going pretty good since Monday. At least I think I have. Sometimes some of these things, it's a little hard to tell whether it's a criticism or not, but that's okay. I haven't had anything where I've just said, yeah, that really isn't, so I've had to restart. So that means I'm on day 4. Hopefully, by next podcast, it'll be day 11. We'll see how it goes. Anyways, still working on Amanda and the Skleberry Tree, which is my children's novel. I'm getting really close, so I think the beta sign-up should be in about a week. I have a couple of things to take care of before I get that done and get that whole thing started. But that's going well. Turned out cute. This week, I saw a rerun. It was either this week or late last week. I saw a rerun of a Nova episode that I had not seen, apparently, or I had ignored when it first showed because it was a repeat. And because I ignored it, that was ice if you heard that bang. Because I ignored it, and because of what was actually said in it, and because, frankly, there were a couple of times when I almost said, yeah, just shut it off. I thought, you know, it'd be good to talk about this episode. And it would be good to talk about the episode not only as to what's in the episode, but also what types of reactions are generated by the episode. Because I think there's a very interesting dynamic that's at work, both in the people that the episode discussed and interviewed, and by the viewers. We'll get to all of that when we get to the end, and I've got a lot of stuff to go through. Hopefully I will make it through all this. But the episode was called What Darwin Never Knew. And it's about the latest advances in genetic research. And the slant of the episode was very much what Darwin never knew, and we now knew, that just proves that evolution is true. Now, evolution, of course, is a very loaded word, because it can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people in terms of whether it's microevolution or macroevolution and all that kind of stuff. But for now, we're just going to discuss it as it was fed out in the episode, and then maybe at the end we'll talk about those things. The episode opened with a list of numbers across it that really is pretty amazing. They were talking about the diversity of life on Earth and how there are 9,000 species of birds and 350,000 species of beetles and 28,000 species of fish. But there's like 2 million living species, and they're still counting. And the question that they posed right at the beginning of the episode was, how do we account for such diversity in life? There is only one answer: evolution. Okay, so fine. So then they went into a history of Darwin, and it was all very interesting. And eventually ended up talking to modern day scientists and giving examples of how this diversity of life arose. And one of the classic examples that is given is really more microevolution, but it is an example of something that actually happens in nature. And things like, there's an Arizona, in the Arizona desert, there is a little mouse that they call the rock pocket mouse. And the scientist said that this is basically the Snicker bars of the desert because all the other animals eat the rock pocket mouse, the little tiny mouse. And basically, the only thing the mouse has going for it is that the color of its fur is the same color as the sand. So it basically just hunkers down, doesn't move, and hopes that the owls and everything else that eats them will leave it alone. That's its survival technique. Well, through a section of this, there has, in the past, there was volcanic activity. And so there is dark rock. Well, if you have this little light-colored pocket mouse on top of this dark rock, of course, it's easier to see. There has is another, not another species, I don't know, maybe there's another species or maybe just an offshoot of this rock pocket mouse that lives on this dark rock that, in fact, has dark fur. And the inference is that there were mutations that caused some of the rock pocket mouse, mices, to have darker fur, and those ones somehow ended up on the black rocks, darker rocks, and they helped them survive more, to where today, after, you know, long stretches of time, now you have this divergence between these two types of mouse. Or these two versions of the rock pocket mouse. One has light fur, one has dark fur. Okay. You know, that stuff does happen in nature. Species do adapt. Fine and dandy. No problem. Out of this, and out of this same basic observation of this same basic mechanism is where the theory of evolution started with Darwin, because he was on the Galapagos Island. He collected a bunch of birds. He took them back. He thought they were all different species because they looked so different. He found out they were all finches. The finches that were on islands where they had to crack hard seeds had little short beaks. The finches that were on islands where they got the nectar from flowers and the pollen from flowers had long beaks. So it very much looked like these animals were adapting to their environment. And the mechanism that Darwin came up with was survival of the fittest. We all know this. Okay, fine. So the evolutionary theory then says that you started out with one common ancestor, and through this mechanism of survival of the fittest and mutations in genes, you just ended up with this huge diversity of life on the planet. So of course, scientists have been studying all this, and they've been trying to figure out how do these mechanisms actually work, how do the genes work, so that we can understand, because if it's mutations in genes that are causing the divergence, we want to understand how that works. Ta-da-da-da-da-da. Okay, so in conjunction with all that, you have the Human Genome Project that happened in, started in 1990, and it mapped all 3 billion base pairs of the human genome, sequenced them all. This was a huge accomplishment. And they also sequenced several animals. So the feeling at that time, and they talked about this in the episode, the feeling at that time was that this is great. We've got this technology now, and this is going to cinch everything, because all we have to do now is take these 3 billion pairs and compare them to other animals and compare them to the whole tree of life, and we can just see where all the mutations are different, what animals share what DNA and what is different and how much is it different, and by that we can just put this jigsaw puzzle together, boomity boomity boom, we are done, we understand how all this works, we know how exactly how everything evolved, ta-da, there you go. Okay. Because that was the philosophy and the approach. There was a general assumption that was made. The general assumption was made on the count of how many protein encoding DNA genes there would be. Our genes, the protein encoding genes, are those things which make the stuff of life. Because transcriptive RNA goes through the DNA, unzips it, makes a little copy, an RNA copy of this protein encoding gene. That gets handed off to a little factory that makes the protein. The protein automatically folds exactly as it should. And that's how everything in our bodies is built. It's all built off these proteins. So since life seemed to be intimately connected to these genes and the mutation of these genes, the guess was that our bodies as humans would have the most complex set of genes since we are at the top of the evolutionary ladder, according to the scientists. So people were kind of taking bets informally, you know. And some were saying that there was going to be 80,000. Some were saying upwards of 120,000. I mean, everybody had a different guess, but it was all into the 80 and 120,000 range. Sequence the DNA, the number comes in. The number is at 23,000. 23,000. Corn. You know, as in corn on the cob, corn has more protein encoding genes than humans do. The nematode worm has the same number of genes as we do. Scientists looked at this and basically went, what? They're trying to figure out what? Because now all of a sudden it's like, okay, there's something we're missing here, which, being scientists, they dug in and went after it. What are we missing? And the answers have come from several really interesting different places. One of the answers that has come in was inside this area of DNA which the scientists used to refer to as junk DNA. Because the philosophy was that all the diversity comes from mutations, it didn't seem troubling at all to scientists that there were vast stretches of DNA that were not protein encoding, that nobody could figure out what it did. Because obviously, that was just left over from this mutation process, and it really didn't do anything, and therefore we'll just call it junk. And so for years, it was just called junk DNA. And when I say vast stretches, I mean 98%. 98% of DNA is non-protein encoding genes. And even to this day, scientists do not know exactly what all of it does. Now, they've made some inroads. They've done good work. They have made some inroads. One of the inroads that they've made into this is there was a scientist that was studying fruit flies. And there's a certain branch of fruit flies that have spots on its wings. The males do, and a certain branch does not. And so he was looking for what genes cause these spots. He found the section that causes the spots. He went over to the flies without the spots, and they had exactly the same gene, which was a surprise. So then they started looking in the areas around the protein encoding gene, and in fact found a section in the area formerly known as junk that was a switch that was turning that gene on and off. And this has been a startling revelation. That yes, there are protein encoding genes, but the reason that we only have 23,000 genes of them and not 80,000 or 100,000 is because we have switches as well that turn the genes on and off, like parameters to a program. In fact, as I was talking to some friends about this week, I was sitting across from an IT guy and he went, right, you send in parameters to a program and you get different results. Yes, in fact, you do. So in this region, they call it the dark matter now, there are apparently switches. They're notoriously hard to find because there's not a good roadmap apparently for them, and you just have to experiment and see what they do and what genes get turned on and off when you have these switches. In addition to all that, there has been some really startling work that has been done that there is a whole other structure inside DNA that is doing some really unbelievable things if you just stop and think about it. They told another story on this What Darwin Never Knew about a scientist who has done some really good work, but he set out, his goal was to figure out how a fin on a fish becomes a limb on an animal. Because according to the theory of evolution, we all trace back all mammals, all land-walking creatures, I think it's all land-walking creatures. They all trace back to a common ancestor that crawled out of the ocean and was a fish. Okay? But there's things that have been troubling scientists for a long time. How do you turn a fin into a limb? Well, this scientist had looked back according to the evolutionary charts, and he said, okay, at that spot in time, I should be able to find a transitional form, something that's half fish and yet might have a limb. And so they look around, they figure out that it's like 30 miles from the North Pole, this really harsh area. That's where they say that it's probably likely that we can find one of these fossils. They make 3 trips up there. They don't find anything at all. Finally, they're talking, should we make a 4th? It's just a waste of time. Let's go. They get up there. They spend multiple days. Don't find anything. I mean, they're just on the verge of giving up. And then one guy says, hey, what's this? And they find this flat-headed fish with upward-pointing eyes. And this fish, he's mostly a fish, and yet he's got his little upper appendages that have the major sections that you would expect to have in a mammal with arms. You have this upper bone area, you have 2 bones in the mid area, and then you have complex bones at the wrist, and then you have digits coming out. Of course, they're ecstatic that they found this. They're starting to do research, they're starting to trying to figure out what's going on. At the same time, there's other scientists doing other research. The upshot of it all is that there are these genes in the DNA called the HOX genes. I think it's H-O-X, the HOX genes. And what the HOX genes are, is they are body plan genes. They're not protein encoding, they're not switches, but they are like the hierarchical rulers of DNA. So these genes give orders to the switches that then give orders to the DNA to create stuff. Okay, this is very cool. Some of the things that are very cool about it. Well, let me just explain then how this guy decided that a fin becomes an arm. And it's really very cool. In this fin, if you look, there is a long cartilage section. They've discovered that by flipping certain switches at certain times, you can elongate that section. And then there's another section in there that if you flip certain switches at certain other times, you can elongate the sections and make the area between the wrist and the elbow. I'm on icy roads and I'm trying to concentrate on driving and not driving off the road and talking at the same time. And then there's some other portions in the fin that if you turn those on and off different times, you can actually create wrists and hands. In other words, what they think they've discovered is that these Hox genes, this body plan gene that supposedly was in this fish that crawled out of the ocean 600 million years ago, that Hox gene had all the plans necessary with all the appropriate switches to build everything from a fish with a couple of appendages all the way through to humans. Even more intriguing is these Hox genes, if I did my research correct, because I hopped out on the internet and did some research on them, H-O-X if you want to look it up yourself, there's only like 40 of them, 40, that make up the entire body plan. It's a surprisingly small number. And yet, it does this amazing function of guiding the development of the embryo as to what's going to be the back, what's going to be the front, how many legs are you going to have, where are the legs going to be located, yada, yada, yada. 40 genes take care of this, the Hox genes. Even more amazing, I'm getting my mail. Even more amazing is the fact that these Hox genes have stayed unchanged for all practical purposes for supposedly the last 600 million years. Now, that's pretty amazing when you think about it. In fact, I was doing some research, and if I remember, the Hox genes, there are segments of the Hox genes that they've actually taken out from, like, flies and implanted them in mice, or taken them out of flies and put them in chickens. I can't remember which. I'm backing into my garage. And it actually works. It works just fine. They are interchangeable across hundreds of years of evolution, which is a pretty amazing thing. So, in addition to that, even more amazing, is that prior to the discovery of these Hox genes, scientists thought that the human, or the eye, had evolved like 40 different times spontaneously from all these different species and from the different types of eye that exist. But in fact, the scientists have now discovered that within the Hox genes, there is a map for the eye. Okay, this is all like really cool. Now then, I tell you all that to tell you, well, this is a quote from, I'm in my garage, so I can actually see my notes again. This is a quote from What Darwin Never Knew. Many of the genes needed to make legs and arms were already being carried around by prehistoric fish. All it needed was a few mutations, a few changes to the timing and order of what turned on and off, and a fin becomes a leg. And another place they said, old pathways can be reconfigured to make marvelously new things. Now, this whole science of studying this evolutionary development, it's called Evo-Devo, is like a really hot area right now. A lot of scientists are studying how in the world all these genes interact. These Hox genes talk to the switches, which talk to the protein encoding genes. And one of the scientists was asked a question. I went out to the NPR website and I was reading through some of the side articles. And one of the scientists was asked this question, and you and other biologists never saw it coming. And he said, I would have bet anything that that wouldn't be the case. I would have thought that the genes involved in making a fly would be different from those that make a human. I would have also thought that it would take a lot more fundamental genes within that toolkit to make a human. I would have thought that the genes you use to trigger the formation of a heart would be totally different from the ones that you would use to make a bone, which would be totally different from the ones that you would use to make the front side of an embryo, different from the back side of the embryo, and so on. It turns out that the same gene or genes are used over and over again, just in different ways and combinations with other genes in a cell. And we're using what I would consider to be, based on my prior intuition, a ridiculous number of a ridiculously small number of genes. Now then, I say all of this to actually get to the point of this whole deal, and I've got to wrap this up because I'm long. I should have been done already. I have a chapter in my book, Still Whispers, called The Glory of Kings. And in that chapter, I quote the proverb that it is the glory of God to conceal a thing and the glory of kings to seek it out. We need to understand that scientists and science is not bad, and scientists are doing good work. I think we need to understand that just like we are battling with our flesh and trying to champion our spirit and listen to our spirit, scientists are in that same battle. And one of the big things that the flesh in scientists who are atheists is trying to tell them is there is no God, and it's trying to interpret everything that they're doing in the context of there is no God. But I think we need to show some grace and some mercy and understand that it is the glory of kings to seek out a matter. And these men and women are doing some amazing work. And we should applaud them for the amazing work that they're doing and not get all bent out of shape if they then push and the rightful conclusions to that work, if they then push them beyond what is really known and say, well, see, that proves there is no God. Okay, well, there is no way to prove one way or another whether there is a God. And you certainly can't prove it through science. You can contend that certain discoveries alleviate the need for a God, but you can't prove that there is no God. If you get out on that end of it and say, well, everything is the result of chance, what you've really done is you've departed from science and you've gotten into philosophy. We need to understand that's going to happen. It will happen because that's the flesh talking. That does not negate the fact that these scientists are discovering stuff that is really cool. And so while someone like me would look at these discoveries like the Hox gene, 40 genes, body plan, shared, does not change for 600 million years, works with switches, which worked with protein encoding genes. If I would look at that as a technical person and I would say, that's what we call subroutines. That's what we call modularization. That you take all these little subroutines and then you build bigger programs that call those subroutines and then you have master control program. That's exactly the way we program. And that is evidence of design. I can look at that and enjoy that, but I don't need the scientists to tell me that they get it too. Because God's taking them down their own journey. And we should not be afraid of science. We should just say, cool, keep looking. Might find something else out that's cool. And frankly, one of the things that I think we're going to find out that's cool eventually, and I've read some little hints of it here and there, I think eventually that we're going to find out that species can adapt without mutations, without the mutations necessarily being random. That's just little Phil Farron prediction here on January the 7th, 2010, that what we are going to find out is that the expression of genes and switches and how DNA works, that those things can be controlled apart from mutations. And as I said, I did see one NOVA program where they were hinting at this and they were developing these mechanisms. I think we're going to find much more of that, that adaptation of the species is built right into DNA and how DNA functions. Because, see, then it's no longer random chance. It's actually a mechanism that God built right into the genome so that animals could adapt to their surroundings, so that animals could diversify. Because, frankly, I don't have any problem whether God spoke it all into existence, every species that's out there, in an instant, in 6 days, with apparent age, or if he started it in the beginning and he put into DNA this amazing ability to diversify and to create different creatures and to create creatures that could survive in different environments. I mean, that's an amazing thing. I don't care how God did it. All I'd like to encourage us today is, let's not get our hackles up when we hear scientists go, see, that proves evolution. We should just see what they're doing because they're doing good work. What can we learn from it? And we should be willing at any given moment to learn from it. And this is where I failed initially when this program was on and it had what Darwin never knew on it. And I went, I'm not watching that. I don't want to watch that. Well, that's ridiculous. Scientific discovery is never going to disprove God. But let's not have our flesh telling us how God is supposed to do things. Let's let our kings go out there and discover things and let that be their glory and let's tell them, good job. And then let's see what we can learn from that. Because my sneaking suspicion is that the farther we get into this, the more his glory is going to be revealed by how he hid some truly amazing things in us as his creation. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.